Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Totally Football Show.
Today,
Chelsea are European champions after a luxury city break in Porto. We salute the Londoners, 1-0 winners over Man City. Was it Tuchel versus too clever by half? Or team with Kante against team without Kante on a night when that name seemed to be everywhere, including between the words Timo Werner and score a goal. Also, in many ways, this doesn't change the task they're facing. Away goals get done away with. And we hail promoted Brentford. Would-be's no longer. Now the Premier League's 50th different team. It's the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Okay then, listener. Hello to you. It's Sunday, 30th of May, and a little bit earlier than we usually drop. But it's been an unusual weekend in many ways. We're joined by Daniel Story. Hello, Daniel.
Hi, James.
Also with us, Dom Fifield. Hello, Dom.
Hi, James.
And Carl Anker. Hello, Carl.
Ahoy, hoy.
Nicely done. Hope you've all been enjoying the weekend. If for many supporters, perhaps the biggest one of the season, would you say?
Yeah, I think I did see a kind of, I don't know if it was a Twitter kind of moaning trend of people saying, oh, I didn't really enjoy or want to watch this Champions League final after the Super League and the kind of relentless season. But actually, I thought it was a brilliant game. I feel sorry for people who couldn't kind of separate their anxieties or gripes with the fact that it was a brilliant game to watch.
Yeah, this is probably the wrong sport to follow if you can't separate your unease with various aspects of the financing of it and podcasts within it, indeed. Anyway, Dom, did you have a good weekend?
Yeah, I did. I really enjoyed the playoff final in the afternoon, and the Champions League final was excellent. Really, really good, intriguing contest. And as much as I'm sort of reluctant to see a Chelsea win at any point as being, you know, them using the underdog spirit, that they were the underdogs in that fixture because City had been so dominant domestically. So it was nice to see a surprise.
Okay, and I imagine, Carl, that you were hugely neutral for Saturday's game.
I have no feelings one way or the other.
All right, then. Well, let's start off. Much to discuss today. Of course, two matches principally, but loads of other things happening with the Euros around the corner and that kind of thing. Let's begin, though, with events at the Dragao, Chelsea's 1-0 victory over Man City.
You're listening to the Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
As the ball is played all the way through to Mendy. And that is that! Chelsea are the champions of Europe again! Thomas Tuchel has overseen a magnificent second half of the season. And Kai Havertz has got the only goal in the final. And Chelsea are the champions of Europe again!
Quizzing's Matt Davis-Adams there with his thoughts on Saturday night's triumph at the Dragao, Chelsea picking up their second Champions League title 9 years after the first. A very entertaining encounter it was. Where do you all want to start as we look back on it? With Cobra Kai, with Kante and his continental coverage, with Pep's plan? What do you think it is, Daniel?
I think we risk normally focusing on the mistakes by the losers, and most of the coverage, I think, immediately post-game and probably during the game as well did that. So I think we should start with Chelsea, who were fantastic. The difference between Lampard's team and Tuchel's, not just in their strengths but also in their weaknesses, is absolutely night and day. And I'm amazed at how quickly he has made them so resilient. I thought the best... Kante obviously draws praise because when Chelsea wins, he's always fantastic. But I actually thought Reece James and Ben Chilwell were their best players because the way they shut down Sterling and Mahrez, those two drifting inside and picking up space or staying out wide and beating them down the line, that's been the way City have really improved over the course of this season, I think. And Chilwell in particular I thought was phenomenal against Mahrez, who's probably been City's best player over the last couple of months, particularly in the Champions League. And they are two fullbacks slash wingbacks who might well have lost their England places over the last few months. And I think last night we saw why, for all the clamour for Luke Shaw and Trent Alexander-Arnold, there's a reason why these two have played for England recently, because I thought they were absolutely superb.
Although it was Kante, of course, who popped up on that late Riyad Mahrez chance, which could have taken us to extra time. Dom, you watch a lot of Chelsea. What did you make of the performance? Who stood out for you?
I thought they all were excellent, actually. I agree with Daniel that a lot of the focus in terms of the positivity around Chelsea focused on the younger players, the Chilwells, James, Havertz, even Werner, and the way that he stretched the play, Mount. But I mean, I've done a piece this morning. I think that some of the older heads, some of the old guard, deserve some credit as well. Because if you go back to last season when they got humiliated at home by Bayern Munich in the knockout phase, 3-0 home defeat in February, it was those guys that were completely anonymous. Those guys who looked completely out of their depth, and you just thought, well, they're on their wane. They've gone at this level. Conte wasn't even playing in that match. He was injured in having a succession of little niggling injuries over that period. Under Lampard, and yet here they are revived, and I thought they were just, to a man, they were superb. I mean, I don't have a horse in this race, but beyond the first 30 seconds when Chelsea started very, very poorly and actually almost conceded a corner within that 30 seconds, I thought Chelsea looked completely comfortable, really, until, you know, it was a bit frantic in the last 5 minutes, but you'd expect that when City are chasing a game. It was a consummate performance, and they were by far and away the more cohesive, coherent team, and dominated the occasion, really.
Let's talk about their manager then, Thomas Tuchel. A runner-up last year in this game, a winner this time round, and a man who has Pep's number. And actually, every manager's number, as has been pointed out. He's now faced, let's see the list here, Guardiola 3 times, Zidane 2 times, Simeone 2 times, Klopp, Mourinho and Ancelotti this season. That's pretty much your Euro tactic guru pantheon. And his results read 9 wins, no defeats, only 2 goals conceded. Extraordinary. And a Champions League trophy into there.
Big Sam's got his number, though.
Big Sam. Indeed. Is that, and I'm going to touch on Pep's plan here, is that why Pep ripped things up and went with this experimental no DM lineup? Because his previous attempts in the last 6 weeks against Tuchel hadn't gone to plan. Carl, what do you think?
I think there is something of the Pep overthink theory that we've discussed on this podcast before. How he tends to go into these big games sort of focused on protecting his team's floor rather than giving the initiative. And then you have a sort of cagey 20 minutes from City as the team can't figure out because it's so unfamiliar. And then by the time they revert back to normal, it's too late. And I think some of that happened in the Champions League final, playing without a ball-winning defensive midfielder when you're up against Chelsea, the team with the best ball-winning defensive midfielder in the world, is a certain kind of hubris and or strange decision. City, it's very weird because I still believe Manchester City are the best football team on the planet. I still believe Pep Guardiola is probably the best football coach on the planet. But this is the joy of football. This is the joy of cup competition, random variants and the human element. Can sometimes, you know, it's very fun seeing someone as intelligent as Pep Guardiola have a flaw, which is basically stop messing around and poking the fire.
Let things breathe. The best league manager, but not the best cup manager on the planet?
Possibly. I think what's been interesting in the Champions League finalists and the Europa League finalists is you're seeing masters of what I term the technical narrative and the emotional narrative. So you've got Unai Emery, who is very much someone who's a master of technical narrative, which is what's the stuff going on in the chessboard in front of you. And you've got Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, who's quite good at the emotional narrative, which is who is the person sat across from me or across the chessboard and can I work their flaws. Pep Guardiola, technical narrative. Tuchel and Chelsea have most likely won the Champions League because Tuchel is a man who understands both the emotional narrative and the technical narrative. He understood if I move N'Golo Kante in these areas and use my wing-backs in this situation against Manchester City, that would be really good. And also, Pep Guardiola is a man who's going to panic from these moments onwards if I go a goal ahead. So we just need to fall back into a very, very pleasing compact 4-4-2 shape for most of it. I think that's probably why Tuchel has been so successful in this cup competition. It always helps when you've got someone as good as Kante.
All right. And Kai Havertz, who's, of course, a principal reason why they won this game, scoring the only goal of the encounter, favoured in that exploit by the run of Timo Werner, who, of course, drew off one of the City defenders. And Havertz notching up his first Champions League goal for Chelsea. And then afterwards, with a bit of post-game brilliance, did you enjoy his interview, Daniel?
Yes, I did enjoy his interview. I don't think I've ever heard a footballer say what we're all thinking quite so eloquently and bluntly as he did in that moment.
Because there's a lot of pressure on you, you're the most expensive Chelsea player ever. You've paid it all back in one night, nearly.
To be honest, right now I give a on that we won the Champions League.
Yeah, I'm really happy for Havertz because, as that interview referred to, he was a very expensive player and he has had a kind of sort of flitting in and out season. And I think to an extent that's because he feels like a kind of flitting in and out player. He's almost got a sort of more aesthetically pleasing Thomas Muller vibe about him, in that he seems to be constantly looking for the space and happy to kind of sit on the fringes of a game. But then, you know, when he makes that run, and it was the best run he made all night, and he did one for the, in the second half as well, that ended with a, Christian Pulisic should have scored a second goal. He doesn't seem to mind that much where his performance level is for 60, 70 minutes. And even if he's touching the ball that much, when he makes those runs, he wants them to be decisive. And he did so brilliantly last night. He's not a man who will win Man of the Match awards, but he is a man who will play vital roles in games that Chelsea and Germany win, I think.
I mentioned Timo Werner's run because I think we all feel a bit sorry for him. But the bigger part in the build-up to that was, of course, the wonderful Mason Mount Kaká-esque assist.
He's just been phenomenal all season. He's just been brilliant. I mean, it's amazing to think that there are supporters out there that were criticising him at stages this season. And there was a comment made post-match last night about the media being against Mason Mount. I'm not sure that's the case. I think the media have actually bought into how brilliant he is throughout most of this season and last. But there were a group of maybe it was his association with Frank Lampard. Maybe people thought that Frank Lampard was getting an easy ride as Chelsea manager, and they took out that frustration on Mason Mount. But the kid has been absolutely outstanding for Chelsea. They're Player of the Year by a country mile. And the pass, the arc, the vision, the delivery of that pass to set Havertz away was exquisite.
Yeah, on the Guardiola thing, I mean, it wasn't just that he played without the defensive midfielder, because he ostensibly did play with the defensive midfielder. He just played Ilkay Gundogan there in a role that he's moved so successfully away from. That was the thing that was most odd to me. There was a couple of times, there was one in the first half and also two in the second after he'd been booked, where you saw Gundogan kind of run forward as if to join with a move, and then think, oh, hang on a minute, remember, I'm not going to be doing that in this game. I'm meant to be settling. Now, to me, the European Cup final is one of those games where you don't want to be thinking about new things because you're already tense, you're already under pressure, you're already nervous. You want to be working on muscle memory. And you saw Gundogan kind of having to change his muscle memory at least two or three times. And, you know, I think if they'd have just played, it would have been a real shame to drop Gundogan for that final. And I can see maybe that Guardiola wanted to reward him for the season. He might not stick around much longer. He's been brilliant this season. So maybe there was a case of just wanting to fit him in. But even just replacing Rodri with Gundogan, I think they would have been far better.
Yeah, there's an American coaching maxim, which I believe is you dance with the girl who invited you to the ball.
Yes. Yeah. Also known as do what brought you to dance.
Okay, well, that's simpler. That's much nicer. Chelsea, just the one goal, but about 12 N'Golos. We should talk about him. Kante, who, I mean, there are various explanations of his astonishing prowess, the football brain on that guy. But effectively, he's from 5 minutes into the future, no? In that he doesn't ever seem to be hurried, and yet is always there.
He's a phenomenal footballer. 3 tackles, 10 ball recoveries, which I think that's the fun thing. It's not only is he winning the ball all the time, but he's only really having to make tackles 2 or 3 times as course correction. And I think we've slowly gone away from saying N'Golo Kante is Energizer Bunny who runs around the pitch. And we are now fully understanding he has an ability to see where the ball is going. That borders on precognition. His presence and his understanding of his own gravity on the football field is quite interesting. I really like that phase on the Conte where he wore red boots, and there were two or three times where he would be able to put off a defender because he knew if I just moved 5 yards forward, the other football player would absolutely lose it and make a mistake. And I the fact that he's a man in a match against Atletico Madrid, second leg, man in a match Real Madrid, first leg, man in a match Real Madrid, second leg, man in a match in the final. There's maybe five players on the planet right now currently playing that you can say absolutely you are an all-time great, and I think Kante now has moved into that conversation, and if the Euros go well for France, he can probably start putting his Ballon d'Or campaign together.
He won more aerial duels than anybody else on the pitch, and he was the smallest player on the pitch. I mean, it's just absolutely ludicrous. I mean,
it's the fun thing that, you know, he's footballing invention and intuitive imagination can be far better than his sort of physical attribute.
Yeah.
There was that little bit where Chelsea had a cross coming and Ruben Diaz and Zinchenko were going up, and Kante was smart enough to know if I just, you know, reconfigure myself here and launch myself here, then I'll get my head to the ball ahead of these much taller players. He it's bizarre that he is so good, and yet we still can't properly quantify the hows and whys of why he's good. We almost underestimate his footballing genius. And it is nothing short of genius and artistry now.
I think the thing I like about him the most is that his game, which is probably a role since Makélélé that has been kind of underlooked, is so obviously wrapped up in his humility as a person as well. It's effectively a self-sacrificing role that he's been so successful at doing that it's kind of inadvertently made him the star. You know, Chelsea players carrying around the pitch at the end, and even at that point he's kind of thinking, well, why are you all doing this? Like, I didn't score the goal, I didn't do this and that. But that humility is so part of that, and it's so endearing to watch as a relative neutral.
It was brilliant when other players are sidling past, lining up past the European Cup after getting their medals after the game, and most of them have sort of planted a kiss on Big Ears, probably flaunting all kinds of COVID-19 protocols en route. But Conte gets in front of it, and he doesn't want to do the same. So he just sort of gently pats it on both sides, and then just walks on and waits for the captain to come and present it to him later on. I love him to bits. I just think he's an absolute phenomenon.
As you point out, of course, he's been past one or two trophies in recent seasons. Sam writing in saying some Edouard Mendy analysis and appreciation wouldn't be amiss. I mean, I think particularly after, was it Sasha the other day was saying that Chelsea desperately needed an upgrade on Mendy, which excited some comment among listeners. Also, probably Christensen coming in for Thiago Silva and doing a pretty faultless job in his place. What did you make of Mendy?
Yeah, I mean, he was pretty quiet, wasn't he? Because he was allowed to be, but he's brought that, you know. And it sounds incredibly harsh, but it's an inevitable comparison. It's not just that he's a very good keeper; it's that he solved Chelsea's biggest issue last season. Whether it was their biggest issue on the pitch in quantifiable terms or not, psychologically it felt like the thing that had to be solved if they were going to go deep into competitions like this. And he's just brought again, almost a Kante-like calmness and tranquility to everything he does that just allows everyone else to feel like, hang on, even if we make a mistake here, someone's got it. So if someone in attacking midfield makes a mistake, they can believe Kante will sort them out. If a defender makes a mistake, they believe Edouard Mendy will help them out. And you can't kind of overestimate just how much that helps a team express itself when they know they've got guys behind them who've got their backs.
Other stuff popping up on social media, well, the obligatory Duncan Alexander tweet: City had fewer shots on target than Cheltenham had against Man City this season. Nice one there. Lian Toomey, meantime, flagging up the piece that he wrote, Dom, saying Munich felt like an ending, but Porto feels like it should be a beginning. And I totally get his point. The only thing is, though, with Chelsea, one never really knows, does one? Colin Miller making the point that all three previous European winners at the club were gone within months of their triumph. It's hard to imagine anything like that befalling Thomas Tuchel right now. But Dom, is this time going to be something to build long term on?
I don't think Chelsea are going to change the way that they approach things. So when we talk long term with Chelsea, we're talking about players we're not talking about coaches, really. I think it would be foolhardy to sit here and think that Tuchel is guaranteed. I mean, he'll get a new contract out of this, clearly, but it's still unlikely that he fulfills his contract because this is Chelsea and the first blip that comes along usually costs you your job.
Right.
He made that point, really, on the pitch post-match when he met Abramovich for the first time and spoke to him and you know, it's all downhill from here almost, was his sentiment. But Liam, absolutely, that is right. And 2012 was about a generation of Chelsea players, great Chelsea players. They may not have ducked out immediately after 2012, apart from Drogba, although he came back. But they were on the wane. The club was moving on, the Cheks, the Drogbas, the Terrys, even the Lampards, really, to a certain extent, Ashley Cole. This team has got some senior figures around who, you know, the Azpilicueta's been there for he's been there for 9 years. Thiago Silva, obviously, is on a short-term deal. Antonio Rudiger, you can argue. Jorginho, possibly, they're not going to be there long-term. But they've got a nucleus of really bright young things who are going to be at that club for a period of time. And that made that result last night a bit of a warning for City, for United, for, you know, for everybody else in the Premier League and possibly across Europe, that these guys have won it and they're young. They've experienced that. They know how to do it now. There's possibility that as a generation, they could go on and do something quite special. It doesn't have to be under Tuchel. It can be under anyone at Chelsea, but, you know, there is that potential there.
That Rudiger tackle, by the way, I can't remember who the chance was, but that was extraordinary.
That's absolutely sensational, wasn't it? It was to block Phil Foden, wasn't it, the ball was arrowing to the far corner. But and then he smashed De Bruyne's nose and damaged his left eye socket as well later on, which was not so good. But
not
I don't
so
think
good.
It was deliberate, but
yeah, it wasn't entirely undeliberate either. No. From a City point of view, their supporters may feel, well, you know, we did come close. It was only one goal. Had things been a little different, had that tackle not happened, had KDB stayed on the field, maybe it would have been, if Mahrez had had more luck with that chance right at the death, we would have gone to extra time. How much difference do you think KDB's exit did make? Would it have been different if he'd stayed on the field?
I think different in terms of in relation to substitutes. So De Bruyne wasn't doing particularly well as the false nine. I think he's, you know, top three, maybe top two passes of the ball, but he was almost did a disservice because he was beginning to drop deep to try and offer options for Sterling and Mahrez to go forward, but that wasn't quite coming off. So maybe if he had stayed on and Gabriel Jesus had come on later on and De Bruyne dropped down into 10, things would have improved, but it wasn't a great Kevin De Bruyne performance. It was quite sad to watch him go off. Wright Thompson once said certain things should not be allowed in high definition in football. And that was definitely a moment. I felt as if I was privy to a very private moment and I felt quite sad for him. It was very unfortunate there.
Why do you think he didn't perform? Was it just not his day or was it something to do with the tactical setup?
I think it's a little bit of both. I've spoken to this with Dom and others. Kevin De Bruyne can be got at in bigger games. This is not to say he's not good in big games. This is not to say he's whatnot, but he can drop a 6 out of 10 in a big game in a way that you'd be surprised the player of his talent can. Kevin De Bruyne has everything within him to take the majority of football games by the scruff of the neck. And there are some big games, also indeed some small games, where he can't for, you know, reasons. You can sledge him, you can annoy him to a certain amount, you can get his preparation wrong and he doesn't quite perform the way you want him to perform, which is a strange wrinkle for a player of that talent. There are far less technically skilled players that are more able to go, I'm just going to play at this level regardless. But I think part of that is just who De Bruyne is as a person. And sometimes, you know, that sort of emotional fluidity makes him go supernova and he drops a 9 out of 10 out of nowhere because he's angry. So I wouldn't want that ability to stop. But there is a small weakness to Kevin De Bruyne in the same way there is a small weakness to Pep Guardiola. That's very much something that happens above the shoulders rather than below him.
I should say De Bruyne has tweeted on Sunday morning to say that he has an acute nose bone fracture and a fracture of his eye socket. So, I mean, at first we all assumed it was a concussion injury. And then you saw, I think it was Cancelo or Ruben Diaz trying to pick him up off the floor, and the medical staff kind of saying, yeah, hang on a minute, that might not be that helpful given the circumstances of what's happening. And then he just looked like he had a shiner and was kind of being brought off as a precaution. But yeah, two broken bones in the face, which is, yeah, is a pretty serious injury. I don't know if it puts his Euros in doubt, but well, we're still waiting to hear news on that, but it must put that in slight jeopardy, I'd have thought.
Good Lord, yeah. Wearing a face mask, I imagine.
Fractured eye sockets are bad, though, aren't they? James Tompkins had one this season, was out for about 10 weeks, which would take De Bruyne well out of the Euros, potentially.
Crikey. All right, well, while we wait to hear more on that, it is the third year in a row that the Champions League has been won by a German manager, Klopp, Flick and Tuchel. It's the second European trophy in a row that's been picked up by an ex-PSG manager after Unai Emery's triumph on Wednesday. Carl, City missing out though. They got to the final this time. And, you know, the journey, when you think that today is the 30th of May, and it was on this day in 1999 that the greatest goal in City history, at least until Sergio Aguero, etc., happened, actually got them out of the third division. And on, you know, first steps on this road, I suppose, to a Champions League final. And they'll be back, as Pep said, after they've all had a bit of a lie down.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is it takes about a decade to sort out your Champions League. We've seen, you know, we saw this with Manchester United under Ferguson. It took several years to translate that domestic dominance into continental dominance. Arsenal were very, very good. And then they had their sort of crescendo in 2006 and haven't come back since. Chelsea get Abramovich money in 2003, 2004. And then it takes them, you know, 10 years and a bit to figure out how to win a Champions League, which they get in 2012. This is the fun thing about the Champions League in its current state. No matter, there is a degree of variance, oddity, and just learning experience you need, you know, several years to figure out. PSG still haven't won it with all their money. So I look forward to the Swiss format completely ruining this. I'm going to miss away goals so much.
And we'll talk about away goals later on, Carl. But congratulations to City and Chelsea. Both of them contributed an excellent final. I think that there might have been some doubts about whether seeing them go at it for the third time in 6 weeks, etc., was going to be all that enthralling. But it was a blast. Daniel, it looks like you were shaping up with a final thought on this.
No, I just thought it was really nice for Tuchel, was that a year ago he kind of had that leg in plaster and had to sit there and couldn't move and kind of was intent to make up for it in the last 10 minutes by basically acting as one of those kind of ultra, the guy that stands at the front of the ultras and commandeers everyone to... Yeah, with the megaphone. He was basically doing that for the last 10 minutes, just constantly G-ing up the crowd. And the commentator...
Glenn Hoddle wasn't happy about
Hoddle was saying, you know, you want someone to be calm. And to be honest, Hoddle was kind of right. You want the players to look at the manager and feel like he's got it sorted. If anything, he looked like he was just kind of... He was supremely confident that Chelsea were going to hold on. And therefore, he was just kind of enjoying that extended moment of victory after last year. So, yeah, I thought that was really nice to see him kind of fully buying into that.
I loved the fact that he was conducting any crowd. We've got a crowd back. It's brilliant. Yeah. I mean, I was a bit perplexed. I know what Glenn Hoddle was trying to say, but I just think the context of the last 15 months, it was just, let's get a din in the stadium, a happy, joyous din, and that tension that comes with it. And, oh, that was brilliant to see.
Mm. Saturday was a busy day and a brilliant one all round for West London football. A few hours before events in Porto, Chelsea's neighbours Brentford securing promotion to the Premier League in the Championship playoff final. Let's talk about that next.
Euros are here and you'd better make the most of them because they only come around every 4-5 years. So if your bookie isn't making you feel special, then maybe it's time to find a new one. Yep, not so much carpe diem as carpa diem, yeah? If the grass is greener on the other side, come and play on it. If your bookie's not giving you the best rewards, switch and you'll get a completely free £5 bet builder on all England's group games. Paddy Power. Pre-match bet builder bets only min 2 plus legs online exclusive must have previously deposited to avail. T's and C's apply. 18 plus bgambleaware.org.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
The curse is broken. The pain of playoffs past is banished. The Premier League beckons for Thomas Frank and Brentford.
Premier League has its 50th different team. Very excitingly, Saturday at Wembley, a year on from losing in the promotion final against Fulham, Brentford secured their place back in the top flight of English football for the first time in 74 years. It is the longest gap between two top flight seasons in English football history. It was a pretty comfortable game in the end against Swansea.
Yes, it was. Scoring early always helps, obviously, to settle undisputed and inevitable nerves. But this was basically the Brentford that Thomas Frank wanted to see in the playoff final last season and has seen for most of this season with the occasional wobble. They are a side that has incredible control over games and an incredible confidence in what they're doing. And there's a number of leaders who seem to kind of step up at different times in games. Tony is obviously the headline for his goals, but Pontus Janssen is a kind of leader by personality. But, you know, Emiliano Marcondes is exactly the same. And they're just... I thought Ethan Pinnock was brilliant yesterday. Phenomenal at centre-half with Janssen. And yeah, they're just... I'm delighted to see them in the Premier League. I, like Dom said with the Champions League, I don't really have a horse in the race, but the way they've performed over the last 2 years and the freshness of them in the Premier League, I think there will be far more Leeds-like than Fulham and West Brom-like.
Daniel, is there a slightly wistful note to your voice there? Watching a Championship side that's well-run, securing promotion to the top flight.
Yeah, there is, because Brentford and we should say Norwich as well, who obviously won the league, they are clubs who, in a very similar way, are exactly the blueprint of what you should do in the Championship, which is to scout meticulously. You know, I tweeted it yesterday, scout meticulously. Don't be afraid of selling players. You know, see that as a positive, not a negative, because it allows you to buy cheaper ones that you'll then sell again for profit and trust the manager. And yeah, there are clubs in the Championship, of which the one I support is one, who have got this kind of, I think it's an accidental or kind of inherent arrogance rather than an overt arrogance, but that they can do things a different way. And recent history shows us that just isn't the case.
Less recent history, of course, has different things to tell. And funnily enough, on this day, Daniel, as you're no doubt aware, today's the 42nd anniversary of that 1-0 victory over Malmo, the first of the two European Cup successes for Forest.
As you and any other football supporter will know, Forest fans don't really like to talk about it. So, And on a very brief point, there is a very weird position for me to be in as someone who wasn't born when either of those finals happened. There's a kind of jealousy of fans of your own club, which is a very odd position to be in. I wouldn't take it away from them from the world, obviously, because it's also part of my supporting, and yet I didn't get to experience any of it, which makes me one of the unlucky ones, I think.
Right. Well, one man who did get to experience, thankfully, the full delights of Brentford's promotion on Saturday, experienced them all too well, was Billy Grant of the Besotted podcast, and he joins us now. Billy, how are you this morning?
Oh, mate, I'll tell you something, I'm buzzing. I've actually not been to sleep.
Billy, I'm interested to know what you think will happen now with the B team structure at Brentford and whether promotion to the Premier League actually means that the Brentford go a different way again, or do they maintain that B team structure, or do they reintegrate an academy facility back at Brentford?
The B team structure has been really good for Brentford, obviously, and it's worked for us. Matthew Benham's always been interested in developing players. That's why he got the academy. The shame with what happened was that a few of our very key players that we thought would come through, unfortunately, got plucked off by bigger teams, you know, Man United and Man City's. And so what's happened is that we just, I think for Matthew Benham, he's thinking, I'm investing in an academy, but if my best players are coming and being plucked off by these bigger teams, I don't need 50,000, 100,000, 150,000, you know. Chris Meppen, who came through our B team, we sold him, you know, played 30 games for Brentford, we sold him for 15 million. And he wants to develop these players and put them into the first team. So I think at this time, he felt that the B team is going to be a better setup, because at least if you can sign players on contracts, you don't get the poaching type thing happening. So it's allowed us to develop players who have been maybe dropped off from other academies or not quite there at other levels, and we develop them. But I do believe when we come back to the Premier League now, he will always look at the opportunity, you know, the opportunities, and I think he will definitely look at the academy. Not saying 100%, maybe there might be a combination of the two where you've got the B team, the academy leads into the B team, maybe, or something like that. But it's not something he's averse to. But at the time, he needed to invest all his money into getting us to the Premier League, because once you've got the Premier League, then that helps you to actually fund things like academy, because they're not cheap.
No, absolutely. It's incredible the list of names who've got on to play in the Premier League from, or even manage in the case of Dean Smith, from Brentford: Ollie Watkins, Saeed Benrahma, Neil Mopay, Ezukonsa, Tarkowski in Dallas as well. But after a season spent watching Fulham kind of struggling in your place in the top flight, how confident are you about the Bees being able to come in and truly make their mark?
I think, well, first of all, they've been planning for this for years, okay? They sit down and they're playing the players that they want to buy probably 18 months ago. They know exactly who they want to buy, who's they're going to shift around in the side. As you know, they're very good in the way they use the analytical data to find rough gems that nobody ever knows. And the fact is that going to the Premier League is going to give us bigger pots to play with. Now, we're not going to go like Aston Villa and maybe spend £150 million, because that's not what we do. But instead of buying a player for £5 million, we probably buy a player for £8 million or £10 million, or maybe even push the boat out and go £12 million on a superstar player, you know what I'm saying? But that £12 million player to Brentford will be worth, you know, £40 million or £50 million. That's kind of just the way that we work. And I've got the utmost confidence in these guys. And the reason why is that when we first started supporting them, and we come to the Championship, and then Andre Gray comes, and we loved Andre Gray, and then all of a sudden the following summer we had to sell him, and all the fans are going, no, you can't do that. And they're like, don't worry, we'll get someone better. And you think, no, he's not going to happen. And the following season you get someone, then you got Scott Hogan, and then he's better, and then you get Maupay, and then we sell him, and then you get Ollie Watkins. And every time they seem to get the results. So we have to trust our directors of football. You've got Rasmus, you've got Phil Giles. They're brilliant in what they do, and they know exactly what they want, how they're going to do it. They got through this year, through the pandemic, and they got through this year even with injuries. You know, Josh De Silva injured, Rico Henry injured, you know, Pontus Janssen injured. Got the injury, we've got COVID, we've got a restricted squad to people, and they've done the business. So I do believe they're going to go there, and we're not going to do a Fulham, because Fulham spent loads of money and they bought the wrong types of players. We won't do that. I think that we'll be all right. I'm not saying we're going to stay up. I'm not saying that, but what I'm going to say is that we'll do it sensibly. And even if things has happened and we do come down, we'll be a lot more of a secure side if we do come down, because we'll have the money in the pot and we'll have, you know, players who will be able to compete even better. So I'm really confident, and I'm just happy we're going to go to this new stadium.
Absolutely.
Go with all the fans and have a right laugh. That's what I'm really happy about.
Finally going to get to enjoy your new place. What are you most looking forward to seeing there?
The last two games, the Bournemouth game was unbelievable. In the pub with your mates beforehand, singing beforehand, walking down to the stadium, inside the stadium, all your mates together. The atmosphere is great. So for me, I was just thinking, I forgot what this is like. It's a year, and this is what football's all about. This is what I love. And we almost said, like, you know, even if we don't beat Bournemouth, it's going to be great coming to New Griffin Park, as we call it, next season, 17,000 in the Championship, you know, just singing and going out with your mates. So I'm so looking forward to going to football, because that's what it's all about. It's not about watching it on the TV. It's watching it in the stadium. The pre-match, it's the post-match. Going up and down the country, meeting other fans. That's what I'm most looking forward to. And listen, it's a bonus that we play Man City. It's a bonus that we play in Arsenal. It's a bonus to play that. But I also love going to Preston. I love going to, you know, Borough. I love to go in places. I'll go anywhere to go to football. So I don't really mind. As long as football's fact, on the terraces, in the stands, and we're enjoying it, that for me is key.
Brilliant. Billy, it's been lovely having you on. We look forward to hearing from you on your travels then, if we can, when the new season rolls around.
Yeah, listen, thanks very much for having you on your show again. Listen, you guys, and, you know, great show. And you can tell that I'm really happy. You can probably tell I'm probably delirious. I've had no sleep whatsoever for, I don't know, is it nearly full going on to 48 hours now? I'm on a roll. I'm going to get inside the car. My wife's going to drive me in the car, and I'm going to probably conk out in the car on the way home. And my daughter is going to be telling me about her football match that she played, and I'll be asleep, and I'll pretend that I heard everything she said.
Nice one. Top parenting, Billy. Thank you so much, and congratulations. Enjoy the summer.
Okay, Ricky, and you too, man.
Well, that was very much Billy Grant from the Besotted podcast. Magnificent.
Yeah, and great to hear, perhaps fueled by a lack of sleep, but just that kind of delirious joy of not just getting to the Premier League, but realising that going to the games wherever you're going is the thing now. This last 18 months has been horrible, but I do hope that it kind of forges a reconnection, because I'm one of those people who was going to watch my team play kind of out of grim loyalty rather than any huge enjoyment at times. And it does kind of reinforce how much you miss it when it's not there.
Billy was bullish about Brentford's prospects. How much strengthening, this is a question from Kaz B, how much strengthening do you guys think Thomas Frank needs to do over the summer to give Brentford a decent chance?
Bearing in mind that he got promoted without having lost two key players sold last summer in Watkins and Benrahma, and then three players through injury, three key players in that were absent at Wembley, in Rico Henry, Nordgaard in midfield was out, and Josh De Silva, yeah, of course, in midfield as well. So if those guys are back, then there is a depth of quality there, but you have to strengthen if you're going to stand any chance. I mean, and they will want to compete, but I just can't see them changing their model. They may upgrade slightly on the type of signing they make in terms of the fee, but they're not going to suddenly go out and spend £25 million on a player. They're not going to do what Leeds did last summer. They'll be shrewder about it, and there may be something along the lines of the Norwich, you know, Not planning for relegation, but we're not gonna be daft here. We believe in the quality we've got. We believe in the structure and the idea and the philosophy that we've got at the club. We're not gonna rip that up just because we've gone into the Premier League, because we've built this over a period of time because we believe it will work in the Premier League, and I suspect that will sort of dictate the type of signing they make in the summer.
You know, over the last two seasons, Sheffield United, I think their eight most used players when they finished high up the league were their Championship squad. Leeds last season, their eighth most used players were part of the Championship squad. It can be done. I almost feel more optimistic than Billy in that he said, I'm not saying we'll stay up. I think they will stay up. Although they finished third, I think they're the best place of those clubs to do it, because Norwich are going to, it sounds like, sell Buendia and maybe sell Todd Cadwell as well, and it's very hard to replace those two. Brentford have proved that they can do that. So, yeah, why not?
All right, well, congratulations to the Bees. Commiserations to Swansea. We'll be back in a second or two with another top on this day as we launch into a bit of a chat about England.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman, and I'm here to tell you what The Athletic has planned across its podcast network during the Euros. My pod with David Ornstein will become the Athletic's England show throughout the tournament, to bring you all the latest news and insight from inside the England camp every single day. Then we'll also have nightly editions of the Totally Football show, taking a look at all the big talking points from the competition and looking ahead to the next day's fixtures. Now, if you're feeling nostalgic for tournaments past, we've produced an 8-part documentary series that tells some fascinating stories from both on and off the pitch from the last 8 Euros. Elsewhere, Michael Cox's Zonal Marking pod will offer an in-depth tactical breakdown of all the biggest games, while Adam Hurry's Football Cliché show will take a look at the tournament's alternative storylines. So, as this never-ending domestic season finally draws to a close, we'll have plenty of Euro 2020 coverage for you to enjoy as the tournament gets underway in just a couple of weeks' time.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Hey, listener, 30th of May is a busy one. In 2006, on this day, Theo Walcott, aged 17 years and 75 days, became England's youngest international ever in England's 3-1 victory over Hungary at Old Trafford. Building up, of course, to the 2006 World Cup in Germany. It was a game also noteworthy for Peter Crouch's robot dance after he had scored England's third goal. Was Walcott one of the most shocking tournament call-ups of all time, would you say? Just to, you know, contextualise this, he'd yet to play for his club in the league, let alone for England. And when I say his call-up, by the way, I also don't mean for this friendly. I mean the fact that he got taken to Germany in place of, who was it instead of? Jermaine Defoe, certainly, and Darren Bent.
Yeah.
It was the strangest one in recent / living memory. Theo Walcott is a very curious footballer to me because there was definitely a point in his career where he was not, you know, his talent did not suggest he was, you know, worthy of the accolades he was getting. And there was definitely a point where it looked like it might have got there. Then he gets the ACL tear, which unfortunately takes one or two rungs off his talent ladder, shall we say. And he's just, there was definitely a point where Theo Walcott was good and was that good and was good enough to what all the newspaper headlines and whatnot matched. And I think we forget that sometimes in between watching stints of him play for Everton and indeed Southampton and indeed some of the early bits at Arsenal. It's still quite weird that he is in his 30s. Time moves forward.
Well, it does. Sven, though, he was going into his third and last tournament with England, the Germany World Cup, and does feel a little bit like he was just so, well, screw it. That's just...
It was the omission of a Defoe or a Bent was odd in that context because Wayne Rooney was recovering from a metatarsal injury. Michael Owen had hardly played at all since the turn of the year. I think he'd hurt possibly his own metatarsal on New Year's Day in a defeat at Spurs, I want to say, for Newcastle. And I think he'd only featured fleetingly for Newcastle over the range of that term. And although he went on to play in those friendly fixtures and started the first two group games, I think, in Germany, he then did his ACL in the opening exchanges of the Sweden game, the third match. And a lot of the comment around that injury was that the muscles in his leg simply hadn't recovered properly and therefore it put more strain on the knee and the knee had twisted and he'd gone down. So England probably could have done with a striker at that point to help the robot up top, but didn't have one. They had a 16-year-old kid who didn't kick a ball at the tournament instead.
Mm. Didn't work out too well for Theo either, I think. I mean, we mentioned the perception of players and the pressure that puts on them. I'm not sure how much it helped his career. Jermaine Defoe certainly didn't help him because this, I think, was the third, or it was one of three occasions that he'd been in the mix for a tournament for England and didn't get the call up. The reason I know that is I've just read a piece on, funnily enough, The Athletic called, it's basically about when athletes get cut, which is a very topical thing at this moment. Gareth Southgate preparing for Tuesday when he has to announce a slim down England team. Starts actually this article with a terrific story from the French camp from France ahead of Euro 2008, where Domenech tells the entire team to go to their rooms and he's going to come by to knock on the unlucky sevens doors to say, listen, off you go. And when he gets around, he discovers that Samir Nasri has already been around randomly knocking on people's doors just to put the wind up. Anyway, Anyway, there's all the classics in there, including Gascoigne bursting into Phil Neville's "I'm sorry, Phil" chat and kicking a hole in a wardrobe and stuff. But yeah, so that's what awaits on Tuesday with Gareth. I'm sure he'll find a very, very understanding and friendly way of doing it. But yeah, so seven players have to go from the 33. Who would your seven be? Or do you want to try and pick a team for this England game against Austria on Wednesday?
Ooh, okay. So I had a go at predicting seven for another article on The Athletic.
Okay.
And I made the call to, unfortunately, tell Harry Maguire he will not be joining us for the Euros because I think he's got ankle ligament damage. And I don't want a Harry Maguire with that many painkillers in him trying to play football in the group stages for England. I think it's better off if he just rehabs at home rather than grins and bears it. I think Aaron Ramsdale will be getting a polite nod and a goodbye because I don't believe you need four goalkeepers at a tournament. I think what's been interesting about the Champions League final is, you know, the teams that featured in European finals will not be featuring in at least one, if not two, of the friendlies due to they're not going to get back until Tuesday. So I can see Reece James's performance in this Champions League final probably giving him the nudge ahead of the other right backs, which has a knock-on effect for everyone else. So Reece James seemed excellent. Kieran Trippier's just won La Liga. Someone will probably have to go unless you reinvent Kyle Walker as the centre-back only. And then send some other people home. I think one of the Bens, either White or Godfrey, will go home. And Bukayo Saka's versatility might work against him in a 26-person squad. That's my guess. Oh, wait, I haven't named seven, have I?
Yeah, you're missing one, I think.
It's Watkins versus Greenwood in my head. And I think the Europa League might have given Southgate what he needs to tell Greenwood, "I'll wait for the World Cup next year."
Okay. And what about the 11, Dom and Daniel?
I will shy away from picking the one against Austria because I think it will be heavily, clearly affected by the players involved in finals. I'm happy to try and pick one for the first group game against Croatia, which I think will be Pickford, Trippier, Maguire if fit, Stones, Shaw, Henderson, Rice, Mount, Foden, and then it's Sterling, Kane, or Sancho, Kane, I think. And I think he'll go Sterling, Kane.
Dom, what did you make of that?
I think he'll play three at the back against Croatia. I think he'll start the tournament with three at the back, although that will depend again on Harry Maguire's fitness. I imagine he will play... Oh God, this is going to be tricky now. Pickford, Walker, Maguire, Stones, James and Chilwell as wing-backs. Mount. Oh, my word. Henderson, if fit. No, wait a minute. No, it'll be Rice. It'll be Rice. Oh, I don't know anymore. I've lost it. we'll have Henderson and Rice in the middle. Yeah. We'll have Mount and Foden playing off Kane.
Okay. I mean, you've just come off burying your head in the Champions League final. I think there'll be a day or two while we readjust to the build-up to Euro 2020. Daniel, I think that the difference with you is that you've been counting down to Euro 2020. Well, I mean, we all have for over a year because of the date and that, but for a very long time. You're more excited and worried about it, naturally, but you're more excited about this England team than you have been for a while.
Yeah, you're absolutely right in that I'm more worried about it because I'm more excited about it. Yeah, since 2017, basically, this was the tournament that we had the biggest chance of winning because it was a Europe-only tournament, and it was 3 years after that unprecedented summer of youth success, and seven of the players from that summer are in this squad, including Foden and Mount, who will start, including Reece James, who starred in the Champions League final. So it is brilliant, but it's just that last 16 draw that really worries me.
Seven is a big number as well, because seven games that England potentially could be playing here at home, and seven of the 33-man squad actually starting in the Champions League final, which is extraordinary. When we think of Chelsea and Man City, we don't think of them being all about homegrown talent, or at least not through the years, but this was very much a Champions League final that was all about England. I mean, that was the dominant nation.
Just need to get Kante that dodgy passport and we might actually win a tournament.
All right, well, we'll have loads more build-up, of course, to Euro 2021. I've got a couple of totally preview shows of the teams and their prospects. And there's also, as mentioned, an England-focused podcast with daily England podcast updates, all coming to you from The Athletic. In this show, still to come, the away goals rule is going. Should we mourn its passing like Carr or celebrate the lifting of this curse on football fairness? We'll be having a chat about that. First, though, let's get some odds from Carl Monaghan of Paddy Power.
Hello, James. Hello again, listeners. Euro 2020 takes centre stage this summer, albeit a year late, thanks to the pandemic. But rather interestingly for Gareth Southgate's England, the extra year's wait has definitely strengthened England further, and they lie as the pre-tournament favourites at 4-1. Now, players like Foden, Luke Shaw, Declan Rice, Jude Bellingham, Jack Grealish, all considerably better than they were 12 months ago. So Gareth Southgate no doubt boasts a squad full of attacking talent, but will he be able to get the formula right at the business end of the tournament, presuming they get out of their group, which contains Scotland, the Czech Republic and Croatia? Remember, we'll have a free £5 bet builder bet on all England group games. Remember, all three of them at Wembley. France are the second favourites at 5-1. Their chances are massively boosted by the return of Karim Benzema after the Real Madrid striker enjoyed one of the best campaigns of his career to date in the Liga. If Pogba and Kante can stay fit in the middle of the park for Les Bleus, they could go all the way. Belgium, no doubt, have the talent in their ranks, and with the likes of Kevin De Bruyne and Romelu Lukaku, they are sure to leave a mark on this tournament. You can back the Belgians at 6-1. Now, Spain are 7-1 and are hoping life after Sergio Ramos treats them well. Luis Enrique, of course, named no Real Madrid players in his squad, so expect him to be slaughtered in the Spanish press if they don't go all the way. Italy, just like England, get to play all three of their group games at home. This will be a huge advantage for Mancini's Azzurri, who will be a tough nut to crack at the Stadio Olimpico and will certainly fancy their chances of topping Group A. You can back Italy at a price of 15-2. Elsewhere, Germany are 15-2 in the betting as the curtain comes down on Joachim Löw's 15-year tenure after the tournament. They'll be the usual takers on demand shaft, but many don't fancy the Germans this time round, and I'm one of them. Group F certainly looks like the Grim Reaper's one, with France, Portugal and Hungary all fighting for points.
Thank you, Carl. You can find out those odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply, and when the fun stops, stop. Why not get a subscription for yourself, listener to The Athletic, if you haven't already got one? It'll bring you unrivaled coverage of Euro 2020 in 21. You can get all the articles, all the podcasts ad-free, and also Q&As with writers for the bargain price of £4 a month. You can get that at theathletic.com/totally. Lots of managerial merry-go-round type news, particularly if you're a fan of Italian football. I'll race through this because lots of people aren't. But you probably saw that Allegri is confirmed now back at Juventus. And Simone Inzaghi, who was about to renew at Lazio, then went, no, I'm going to Inter because Conte's leaving. And Zidane has confirmed the fact that he's removing himself from Real Madrid. Spalletti's gone to Napoli. And Gattuso's probably going to go to Fiorentina. Yeah, it's all happening in Italy. It's a giddy carousel of coaching.
Is it the case that 18 of the Serie A clubs are changing manager this
that
summer?
That sounds right, Dom. And you wonder what's wrong at the other two. They just haven't done it yet. That sounds right, because I'm struggling to think of one that
hasn't. Atalanta and Milan, is it?
Yeah, that would be it. Yeah, who've had great seasons. Good. Big news on Friday. UEFA, who've now warned again the Rebel Three of Juventus, Real Madrid and Barcelona that they face potential expulsion from the Champions League if they don't renounce their Super League heresy, demonstrated perhaps their new ruthlessness by taking the axe to the pale innocent form of the away goals rule. Crikey, this has been hinted at before. I mean, people have even invoked it, but UEFA just wading in and axing it. It still has to be ratified by the UEFA's executive committee, which is going to convene on July the 9th, but hot takes and impassioned reactions are already coming in, not least from Carl, who said, let me get your quote, Carl, away goals are great, away goals do not count for double, away goals should not count in extra time, but it's so funny we should keep it. Everyone loves away goals, says Carl, until their team gets knocked out on away goals, as happened with Juve and Bayern Munich, of course, in this year's tournament. Do you agree, Dom and Daniel, with Carl's assessment there of the popularity of away goals?
I don't know if I feel strongly about away goals.
What?
I don't know. I'm Daniel. Trying to think, do I or not?
No, I think it... To me, the shame is that that away goals is an intrinsic part of me watching European football, right, and that it doesn't really happen in any other context that English clubs play in. You know, it doesn't happen in the playoffs, which is our only other similar scenario. So that is a shame, but it was brought in the 60s when, you know, for reasons that clubs were travelling to places they didn't know, and therefore they wanted to try and persuade them not to just put 10 men behind the ball and defend all game, which has probably been lost now. But yeah, I think it is a shame, but for kind of nostalgic reasons. And as we all know, nostalgia is king.
Absolutely. Carl, would you like to respond to that?
I still think away goals has a place, even if in the age of private jets and slightly more comfortable travel. I mean, the theory is we've got to a new cutting edge of the tactical game. And yeah, the away goals are meant to encourage a degree of entertaining football, and I've always thought of it not so much as away goals count double, but away goals cost 1.1 goals. So it's sort of the compound interest that kills you. You know, conceding one away goal, not too bad. Conceding two or three, then you're in a bit of trouble. And when you think of how many brilliant Champions League ties have been decided by away goals, you consider Tottenham Hotspur's victory over Ajax does not exist without away goals. You don't get that very weird state where certain stadiums have their own unique aura if away goals isn't in there some way to feed it in. Yes, look, it's not totally fair, but I don't think football and fairness are as natural bedfellows as everyone would like to pretend they are. I utterly love away goals as a concept. They bring the drama that we want football to have, and we pretend football always has. So why get rid of it? Oh, because Juventus are lost, as tends to be the habit with recent things in European football.
I'm not sure if it's necessarily Juve that's been able to exist.
I know it's not Juventus's fault, but also it's Juventus's fault.
Okay, well, it's not a bad axiom to approach football with. But anyway, Daniel.
Martin Lipton put it really nicely on Twitter in a way that I hadn't really thought about. And it's one of very, very few things in sport where you can go from winning, demonstrably winning, to demonstrably losing in the same action. You know, it's one moment to change winning to losing. You could argue in boxing maybe with a kind of late knockout punch or something, but yeah, that is its attraction now, more than the anachronistic reasons it was brought in, I think.
And we're not going to hear commentators saying in many ways this doesn't change the task they're facing anymore.
No, but how long will they spend? How many years will we have to listen to them reminding us that there is no longer any away goals? We're still wasting that time.
Mm.
I really hope it doesn't get ratified. I would love for it to stay.
Peak away goals was the All Milan Champions League semi-final, no? Where Inter went through on away goals despite playing at their home stadium. Genius, because they were facing...
I like the Ovrebo evening. No, I didn't like the Ovrebo evening, obviously, but the Ovrebo evening where Chelsea-Barcelona, where Chelsea were 1-0 up, should have been 6-0 up. And then Andres Iniesta with that unbelievable goal in stoppage time at the end. Yeah, that's exactly what Daniel's just saying. I suddenly really love away goals. I want away goals back.
Well, it's probably another decent axiom to approach football with. If UEFA are planning to change it, it's probably worth keeping. Very good. Dom, I raced through some managerial changes. Who's your new boss going to be at Selhurst Park? Do we know yet?
Oh, I would say one of Nuno, Sean Dyche, or Valerian Ismail.
Really?
So take your pick, really, at any point.
That's
next
a
week.
Fun trio.
That last name again?
Valerian Ismail, the Barnsley manager.
Ah, right.
I thought Eddie Howe would have been... Is Eddie Howe just not in the frame at all?
I don't think
interesting.
So.
Interesting.
Who would you have, Dom?
Roy Hodgson.
I see. That's the tradition.
No,
again.
In fairness, out of those three, I don't know, to be honest. I'm intrigued to see how they would all approach the summer at Crystal Palace, given the amount of change there's going to be.
Right.
I can see that there's an excitement around Nuno, potentially. Mm. But I do wonder whether Sean Dyche might be the sensible option.
Crikey. It's a lot to ponder, isn't it? Carl, I won't ask you who you want at your club next season, because that would take us into a whole new conversation. Let's instead wrap this totally up. As I mentioned, there are a couple of preview shows that we'll be having ahead of the Euros, which start in less than 2 weeks now. So look out for those. And looking forward to hearing from you guys in the course of that that tournament when that gets underway. For now, it's many, many thanks for today and for all your hard work and excellence throughout the season, Daniel, Dom, and Carl, and producer Charlie, of course. And listener, thank you for being with us. This pretty much wraps up the end of this season. The new one's barely days away. I'm not sure actually where you include the Euros in that. But anyway, that wraps it up for today's show. From all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of the Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.